Okay, so this is Bio 160, and it's October, Tuesday, the 14th. And we're sort of in the middle of the nervous system, or we just started the nervous system somewhere in there. So we're going to finish up with that. I just want to remind you that on Thursday, you have a quiz over nervous system, and then a take-home quiz on sensory chapter. All right, so make sure you're in class on Thursday, because again, there's two quizzes. So if you miss Thursday, I think you get gypped out of two quizzes, not just one. So you get a take-home. And then I believe we're scheduled to have a test a week from today over muscles, nervous system, and senses. But you got to come to class on Thursday to find out if indeed we're going to have that test a week from today or not. Depends on how far we get with everything. Okay, the senses chapter is actually kind of fun. But the chapter that maybe isn't as much fun and a little intimidating is nervous system, traditionally speaking. Okay. All right, so let's review a little bit about the nervous system where we started last time. First is structurally, how do we break the nervous system down? Okay. For instance, a good place to start is to break it down into central nervous system versus peripheral nervous system. And you have a good picture in your book that shows that. So make sure you know that the central nervous system is made out of the brain and spinal cord, and the peripheral nervous system is everything else outside the brain and spinal cord. Furthermore, we can break the peripheral nervous system down into two divisions, sensory versus motor. Sensory means it's taking signals from in your body someplace and bringing them to the central nervous system. That's sensory. Motor means that your central nervous system is generating signals and it's sending them out to the periphery. And we can break the motor division down into two kinds. There is a voluntary part and an involuntary part. What's the voluntary part called? Somatic. And what's the involuntary part called? Autonomic. Or maybe you could say automatic, but autonomic is the correct term. Furthermore, we can break the autonomic nervous system down into two divisions, and that is the sympathetic and parasympathetic. And what can you tell me about the relationship between the sympathetic and parasympathetic? Yeah, they belong to the autonomic nervous system, but there's something that makes them different. Something that makes them different. They're the same because they both belong to the autonomic nervous system, but what makes them different? They always have opposite effects. And when that happens, we say that they are antagonistic to each other, right? So if one speeds up the heart, the other is going to slow it down, right? If one causes pupil dilation, the other is going to cause pupil constriction. If one causes an increase in digestion, the other causes a decrease in digestion. They're always going to be antagonistic to each other. But of course, that's a really good thing. Is that right? Because what can you tell me about antagonism? What do two antagonistic mechanisms in some kind of machine provide for? Balance is one important thing, and precise control as well. Balance and precise control. So those are the two things. Okay, so I'm holding up some lecture notes from a previous semester in case you don't have lecture notes on. The lecture notes online are actually better than these because I don't have the figures in here for you to practice labeling the figures that might be on the test, but at least these have the notes. Does anybody need these notes? Okay, I'm going to pass a couple up this way. Yeah. And then once you pass these kind of back over that way. Okay. So you can at least take notes on them. Now, if you don't know how to get those notes online, see me right after class and I can show you how to log in. Make sure that you know what your password is and all that kind of stuff. So this figure right here, you might want to refer to throughout the whole lecture on nervous system because this is just a nice overview of everything. Okay, so last time we also talked about the cells of the nervous system. How many cells are there? Cell types. There are two types of cells, two major classifications. There are ones that send electrical signals. Those are neurons. And then those that don't send electrical impulses, those are neuroglia. They have other functions. Namely, some neuroglia synthesize myelin. That's an insulating material around the axons of a neuron. Okay, others form the blood-brain barrier that protects our brain from harmful chemicals that we have in our blood. So sometimes there are toxic compounds in our blood, and that would kill our brain. So those drugs are kept out of our brain and we're able to live. Like, what kind of drug is very toxic to the brain? Unfortunately, it can get through the blood-brain barrier pretty easily, but that's like alcohol, okay, is toxic. That's why you become intoxicated when you drink adult beverages. But many other kinds of compounds can't get across that blood-brain barrier, and that protects your brain. All right, so I think we were looking at maybe this example right here. Of what a neuron looks like. So here's a neuron, and the center of mass of this cell is what we call the cell body or the soma, and this is the kind of cell that can transmit electrical impulses. And you can see that it doesn't look like any other kind of cell that we've looked at so far, because it has all of these processes sticking off of it, all these projections. These short projections up over here are what we call dendrites. And this is the cell body, or the soma. Soma just means cell body. And this big, really long projection right here is what we call an axon. And electrical signals always flow from a dendrite into the cell body and then down an axon in that direction. So dendrite, cell body, axon, that's the direction of signal flow. It never can go backwards. And you can see that labeled on the diagram right here. A nerve impulse always goes in this direction. Okay, furthermore, we see some swellings at the tips of this axon right here. And so we call that a synaptic knob that contains some very special structures. We're going to look at some structures inside that synaptic knob. Sometimes we call that a terminal button because it kind of looks like a little button. Sometimes we call it a bouton terminale. Sometimes we call it a terminal bouton. So it goes by all kinds of different names. All right, and sometimes I'll just call it a axon terminus. But it has a special function. Okay, so this is a good exam figure to know. So this is what we call a multipolar neuron, transmits electrical information this way. But also on this slide, I see these cells that are yellow colored. These are what we call neuroglia. They don't transmit electrical information, but they help this neuron right here do its job. So you can see if we make a cut through one of these cells are what we call Schwann cells. We find this in the peripheral nervous system. And these Schwann cells wrap themselves around an axon. They wrap and wrap and wrap and wrap and wrap. Can you see all the layers in there? Okay. These layers don't have cytoplasm in there. They have a lipid material. And that lipid material is called myelin. Myelin is an insulation, an electrical insulator. And that just prevents the electrical signal from leaking out of the axon anywhere underneath one of these Schwann cells. So you might be familiar with a wire. Most wires that you have in your house, like your TV cord, things like that, do they have insulation on them or not? As a matter of fact, they do. Because if you were to touch the wire plugging in a TV set, if it didn't have insulation, what would happen? You'd get an electrical shock or you would get electrocuted, right? So most wires do have insulation on them in your house. And these Schwann cells put insulation around an axon so the electrical signal doesn't leak out of this neuron over here. But there's another, even more important function. And that is, notice that this insulation, that these Schwann cells right here, are not absolutely continuous. There are breaks where you can see the axon between these Schwann cells right here. And you got to know what these little breaks are called. Can you see what they're called? A node of Ranvier. And when you have these Schwann cells wrapping themselves around an axon, we call that a myelin sheath. So it makes a myelin sheath that's discontinuous. When a nerve impulse moves down the axon, it doesn't move molecule by molecule by molecule. It actually hops from one node of Ranvier to the next. So So when an electrical signal hops down an axon, do you think it's faster or slower? It's faster. So that kind of conduction is what we call saltatory conduction. When a nerve impulse can hop down an axon, it's much faster. It's about 300 meters per second. That's about 3 football fields in 1 second. As opposed, if it's non-myelinated, it's going to be about 1 meter per second. So it's about 300 times faster if it's myelinated. So I think maybe I asked you this last time. What's better, a fast neuron or a slow one? Like if you go buy a computer, would you go and buy a slow computer or a fast computer? Fast, right? So faster is better for us to have. All right, so if it's a myelinated axon, it's very, very fast. And as a matter of fact, there's some disease processes, or there's one disease process where this myelin disappears in people, in their brain, and it really slows the speed of conduction down, and it really kind of messes them up. Does anybody know what that disease is called? When people lose the myelin sheath around axons, it's called multiple sclerosis. Right? And people can live with that, and we can treat it pretty well, but nonetheless, that myelin is very important just to maintain the normal functioning of these neurons. All right, what about some other cells? So that was a neuron. There's a neuron. And then here's that first kind of neuroglia that we talked about, making that myelin sheath. Here are some other neuroglia and what they look like. Okay, so this yellow one over here again, this is what is making a myelin sheath around this axon that's speeding up the conduction of an electrical signal down this axon. But these cells are what we find in the central nervous system. The Schwann cell is what we find in the peripheral nervous system. Okay, so the neuroglia are a little bit different in the central nervous system. This oligodendrocyte looks a lot like a Schwann cell, except you can see it, reaching out and touching maybe numerous axons or in different locations on one axon. So that's different than a Schwann cell, but nonetheless, it still has myelin. It wraps a myelin sheath around the axon, creating saltatory conduction. This microglia cell right here is really sort of like a white blood cell. Does anybody know what the function of a white blood cell is? We haven't talked about blood yet, but white blood cells fight infection. So microglia fight infections. Or maybe if you have a tumor or some kind of growth in your brain, these microglia will destroy that growth before it gets out of control. So that's a very important cell. They're crawling around in your brain all the time looking for stuff that doesn't belong in there. What's this one right here? What does that look like? That looks like another microglia cell or microglial cell. And indeed it is. It's just not labeled. Here is another kind of neuroglia. This is what we call an astrocyte. And you can see the astrocyte touching a neuron right here, but is also touching a blood vessel, a capillary. So an astrocyte can act as a bridge, taking material from the capillary and delivering it directly to a neuron. So some good things that might move through this astrocyte would be glucose, because glucose is an energy molecule that this neuron can use to make ATP. So glucose can take this direct route into this neuron from this capillary. The other thing that you notice with this astrocyte right here, in this region, you can see that it completely covers the capillary. And that's usually what we see. All these different processes from astrocytes will completely surround the capillary, and that's actually what makes the blood-brain barrier. So if there's harmful compounds in the capillary, they can't just diffuse out into the brain, right, and toxify the neurons that are inside the brain. So astrocytes in particular make the blood-brain barrier. So we got oligodendrocytes, microglia cells, astrocytes, and the last cell that we're going to look at are these ependymal cells. They're kind of a neuroglia cell as well. We have some big cavities inside the brain, and those big cavities are called ventricles. There's fluid inside those ventricles, and the ventricles help give our brain a little shape and structure. and it also helps absorb trauma and shock that's applied to the head. The fluid in these ventricles come from these ependymal cells. So the ependymal cells are lining of the ventricles, but they also produce that fluid. That fluid is what we call CSF, or cerebral spinal fluid. CSF, cerebral spinal fluid. I'll point out where that comes from. I got a couple other slides later on. But it's produced by these ependymal cells. So these are the four kinds of cells in the central nervous system that you should have a feel for what their function is. Oligodendrocytes, microglia, astrocytes, and these ependymal cells right here. And that's pretty much the cells of the nervous system. Okay, well, I guess here's a nice zoomed in region of a neuron with a, now what are these right here? What do these look like? Oligodendrocytes or Schwann cells? These are Schwann cells because they just kind of look like a roll of toilet paper or something wrapped around that axon. Only one of them. And you can see the myelin sheath and this very outer layer right here that contains cytoplasm and the nucleus. That's what we call the neurilemma. So that's actually a living cell, and the cytoplasm is the outermost layer. The inner layers are just made up of myelin, or that insulating material. All right, and just like we had different neuroglia, or support cells, there are different kinds of neurons as well, by shape. This one right here is what we call a multipolar neuron. That's like what we were looking at before, that had Schwann cells around it. These are the dendrites up over here. Here's one long axon. And remember, which way do signals go? 3, 2, 1, or 1, 2, 3, or 2, 3, 1, or which way do electrical signals always go? From dendrites, the cell body, down the axon. So in this diagram, 1, 2, 3. Another kind of neuron is this bipolar neuron. Notice that here's the cell body. And then it's got two long projections coming out of it on either side of the cell. And this is an important cell for certain senses in your body, for instance, like vision and smell and hearing. Use these bipolar cells. So not in very many locations of your body, but they're still very, very special kinds of senses. And then the last kind is what we call a unipolar neuron. It's unipolar because there is just one process coming out of the cell body that very quickly bifurcates into two processes, but it starts as one, therefore we call it unipolar. And the two processes, one long process is going to be in the periphery someplace, like maybe a fingertip or whatever, and these are dendrites that are sensory, they can pick up information, and it sends an electrical impulse this way through the cell body and then down this axon in this direction. Okay, so that would be a unipolar neuron. So what's a common characteristic of all these neurons? What do they do for us? A neuron does what kind of stuff? As opposed to neuroglia? It sends electrical information, right? So all of these send electrical information, while these guys do other things, right? Like make myelin, immune response, blood-brain barrier, or makes cerebral spinal fluid. So those neuroglia do different kinds of things in our body. Okay. So here is sort of an overview of the nervous system, and we got two sides on this piece of paper separated by this dotted line right here. On the left-hand side, we have the central nervous system. What makes up the central nervous system again? Brain and spinal cord, and then everything else is called the peripheral nervous system. So this is just a nice block diagram, and I can see a nerve right here, a neuron, and here's the cell body. Here is just one process coming out that bifurcates. So what does this neuron right here sort of look like? Can you remember what the name of this guy is? Here it is right here. Here's that single process coming out that's bifurcating. What was that one? That was a unipolar. So a unipolar neuron is always going to be sensory because it's bringing signals where? Into the central nervous system or out of the central nervous system. It's going to be bringing them into the central nervous system. So a unipolar is always a sensory neuron. And it says right here, sensory. Now what's another name for sensory? That would be afferent. An afferent neuron is the same thing as a sensory neuron. And then it communicates with a neuron that is, where is this neuron located at? What part of your nervous system? That's in your central nervous system. And you can see the cell body, and you can see the axon, and does any part of this neuron ever find its way into the peripheral nervous system? It's always completely within the central nervous system. And this kind of neuron, and this one right here, these are what we call interneurons. So interneurons are always within the central nervous system. They're never in between. They never are in part peripheral nervous system, part central nervous system. So these interneurons analyze the information that's coming in from the periphery, and then they make a decision on what to do with that information. For instance, maybe you sat down and somebody put a tack on the chair, and you sat down on that tack, and that pain stimulus comes into the central nervous system, your spinal cord. Guess what decision the spinal cord is going to make? It's going to make you jump up off the chair right away. All right, this is a reflex motion, so these neurons are going to stimulate muscles in your legs that make you jump up off the chair. Right, so that's the job of these interneurons. Sometimes they have another name. Sometimes they're called association neurons. Interneurons and association neurons are the same, and they're found completely where? Within the central nervous system. So they make a decision and send electrical signals out to muscles to get you away from that painful stimulus. So this is a motor neuron. Another name for motor is efferent. And that motor neuron is going to stimulate muscles, for instance, or maybe glands or some other kinds of tissue, like smooth muscle or cardiac muscle. So this is just another nice general overview of the nervous system. And you should be able to relate that to what? This first diagram that you have right here. Okay, you got a sensory division, you got a motor division. Okay. All right, so let's look at some terms of the nervous system. Gray matter. What the heck is gray matter? Let me find this nice picture of a neuron right here. All right, gray matter is a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites, and it looks gray. So here is a neuron, and parts of the neuron have a myelin sheath around them, and that makes this part of the neuron, namely this axon, it makes it look white. But places that don't have myelin on them, namely what? The cell body and dendrites, they don't have myelin, so they look kind of gray. So whenever you have a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites in some part of the nervous system, we call that gray matter, and in particular the central nervous system. So there are parts of our brain that look gray because it's not myelinated. They are what? Nerve cell bodies and dendrites. The central nervous system cortex. What the heck is a cortex? Did I ever tell you what a cortex of a... Yeah, because we looked at bone already. So what part, yeah, what part of a bone is the cortex? That's the outer part or the superficial part? That's the cortex, right? So a brain has a superficial part. We call that the cortex. It has a deeper part as well. And we call that the medulla. Any deep part of an organ is the medulla. And it just so happens that in the surface of the brain, it's made up of mostly nerve cell bodies and dendrites. So what color does it look like? It looks gray, right? So the central nervous system cortex contains gray matter. CNS cortex is gray matter on the surface of the brain. It doesn't have any myelinated axons. All right. Furthermore, in the central nervous system, if there is a group of nerve cell bodies someplace, maybe it's not on the cortex, it could be deep inside the brain. So if you look deep inside the brain, it might look white because you have a bunch of myelinated axons. But in a certain location, it might look a little gray. We call that a nucleus. And a nucleus is a group of nerve cell bodies and dendrites that is deep inside the nervous system. And why is that going to look gray again? Because nerve cell bodies don't have myelin on them. So it's going to look gray. All right, so if you have gray areas inside the brain, you have some white areas as well. Okay, so what does white mean? White matter means that it's going to be an axon with what around the axon? Myelin. Okay, so here's an axon that has a myelin sheath. It's going to look white just to your naked eye inside the brain someplace. And if there are a group of these axons going someplace in the brain, not only does it look white, but we give it a name. We call it a nerve tract. So the electrical signals take different routes or different streets or different freeways inside the brain, and we call that a tract because it's white matter. All right, that white matter in the peripheral nervous system, we just call it a nerve. Furthermore, so we talked about a nucleus. That's a group of nerve cell bodies in the central nervous system. You could have a group of nerve cell bodies in the peripheral nervous system someplace. But that we don't call a nucleus, because where do you find a nucleus at? In the central nervous system. So if you have a similar kind of structure in the peripheral nervous system, we call it a ganglion. All right, and I'll show you a picture of what a ganglion looks like. All right, so those are some terms that I'll be using, so you might have to refer to that cheat sheet a little bit as we go through things. Okay. Okay, well, let's change topics a little bit and talk about some, not just structures, but actually some physiology of the nervous system. And this is maybe a little strange to some people, but we are very electrical beings. We're very electrical in our nature. As a matter of fact, every cell in your body acts like a battery. What does a battery have? It has charge. That's right, it has a voltage. How many terminals does a battery have? If you want to measure a voltage on a battery, what would you have to measure? It has two terminals, right? Like a pen-sized type battery has got one end, and on the other end it has electrical contacts. In order for electricity to flow out of the battery, it's got to flow out one end and then flow back in the other. So a battery's got to have two different places, and there's going to be a difference in charge between them. Well, a cell can actually is a battery as well. Every living cell, including and especially nerve cells, develops a voltage across the cell membrane. So in other words, every cell acts like a battery. So let's see if I can show you this. I don't want to show you all these pictures at one time. Okay. So here is an axon. And here is the axon right here. Here is the cell membrane on one side of the axon. Here's the cell membrane on the other. So this stuff right here is just fluid that is inside the cell. And over here is fluid that is outside the cell. And there are a couple ions that we have to pay attention to. There is an ion right here that's got this label K. What does K stand for? Potassium. And then we got another ion called Na, that is sodium. All right, and there are specific proteins in the membrane, right, that pump potassium into the cell and pump sodium outside the cell. And when that happens, you get much more potassium inside the cell than outside, and you get much more sodium on the outside compared to the inside. right? Like over here, this is the extracellular fluid up over here. What ion do you primarily see up over here? You see sodium. And in the extracellular fluid over here, what do you primarily see? Sodium. All right. And then on the inside of the cell, what ion do you primarily see? Potassium. All right. So that's something that I want you to just absolutely memorize in this class. Right. We've got two ions that we're going to be very concerned with. One is potassium and one is sodium. And they are not equally distributed on the outside of the cell compared to the inside. All right, so where is potassium high? This is the first thing you got to just memorize. It's high on the inside. And where is sodium? It's high on the outside of the cell. Okay. And because of that, all right, because of that, uneven distribution of these ions, okay, this is what happens. I guess I'm going to have to just use that same slide, but I don't really want to. Because you have that uneven distribution of ions, when the cell is at rest, you have much more potassium where? On the inside. You have much more sodium on the outside. And because of that, the inside becomes negative and the outside becomes positive. So there's a difference in charge across the membrane, and that's just like a battery, right? So a battery has two different terminals. We could actually measure the voltage on this cell at rest. Okay, and just for your own information, right, if we measure that voltage, it's about minus 70 millivolts. And 1 millivolt, all right, actually one volt is equal to 1,000 millivolts. All right, so that's kind of a small voltage, but cells are what? Really, really small. All right, so why is that voltage there? Because of these two ions, sodium and potassium. Potassium is high, don't forget, on the inside, and sodium is high on the outside. And that makes nerve cells irritable. They can be stimulated. They can be stimulated into transmitting electrical signals. All right? And that electrical signal is what we call an action potential. See if I have that on your slide right here. Yep. Okay, so when the cell is at rest, it's not being stimulated. Please remember these two ions, sodium and potassium. Sodium is high on the outside, potassium is high on the inside. And a cell, these nerve cells, can send a signal, an electrical signal. That electrical signal is what we call an action potential. So that means that, what does action mean? What does action mean? That means something's moving, something's happening. Okay, and this potential just means a voltage. It means that the voltage is changing because these ions are moving around. So an action potential has two components to it. The first one is what we call depolarization, and the second component is what we call repolarization. So I want to show you what depolarization looks like. So you can read the little blurb, or you can look at this diagram right here. So don't forget, when this nerve cell is at rest, what do we have? Potassium on the inside, sodium on the outside. When the nerve gets stimulated, there are channels that open up that allow sodium to diffuse into the cell. Sodium will diffuse down its concentration gradient. So depolarization, you see what? Sodium going from outside to inside. So what was at the resting stage up over here, what about the inside of the cell? Was it negative or positive? It was negative, right? And then when sodium enters the cell, see that little, what is the charge on a sodium? It's positive. So when positive charge enters the cell, what happens to this negative sign inside the cell? What happens when you add a negative and a positive together? They cancel out. right? So the voltage disappears. And so when the voltage disappears, guess what we call that? Depolarization. So here the cell is polarized because there is an unequal concentration of these ions. When a plus charge enters the cell, that minus charge disappears. We call that depolarization. All right, so that's the first phase of an action potential. So what would you call the first phase of an action potential? Depolarization. And why does that happen? Because sodium enters the cell. There are proteins in the membrane that allow sodium to enter the cell. Right? At the same time, the cell is stimulated. There are other channels that open up as well, but they're slower to open up. And that is the second part of an action potential. There are other membrane channels that open up that allow potassium to leave the cell. Right? And when you have positive charges leaving, what happens to the charge inside the cell? Does it become more positive or more negative? When it becomes more negative, right? So the cell returns to the resting state. We call that repolarization. All right, so on this slide, this is a pretty important slide because it shows the resting membrane. We have high potassium inside, high sodium outside, and an action potential because the first thing that happens is that sodium rushes into the cell. That's the first phase. And that's going to neutralize that charge. And we call that, what do we call that when sodium neutralizes the negative charge inside the cell? That is depolarization. And then a little bit later time, the potassium channels open up. Potassium can leave the cell. And that makes the inside of the cell more negative again. We call that repolarization. All right? And it just so happens that this causes a chain reaction. All right? When this part of the membrane depolarizes, it causes depolarization of the next segment of the membrane. And when that segment depolarizes, guess what? It causes the next segment of the membrane to depolarize. And when that depolarizes, what happens? The next segment depolarizes, and then the next one, and the next one, and the next one, all the way down to the axon terminus. And then after depolarization, what happens? Repolarization. All right, so some of the typical kinds of questions that I would ask you would be, what's the first phase of an action potential? Depolarization. And what ion is responsible for that, for depolarization? You would say sodium, and you would say also, I could ask you, which way is sodium moving? Sodium is going from outside to inside the cell. That's depolarization. That's depolarization because remember, at the resting state, the inside of the cell is negative, so if we add positive charges to the inside of the cell, it depolarizes. And then what's the second phase of an action potential? Repolarization. And what ions are responsible for that? Potassium, and which way are they moving? Outside, from inside to outside the cell. Okay. Now I realize that you don't have a real good feel for what's going on, all right, with an action potential, but I think you should just memorize those things because if you ever take a little bit more advanced class, right, that's exactly where we start and get into a whole lot more detail. So it'd be really handy for you to have that, at least that information on the tip of your tongue. Okay, action potential's got two parts to it. Depolarization first, repolarization after that, and that's due to currents of sodium and potassium across the membrane. All right, so this just shows you a region of an action potential. So we see positive charges entering the cell. What do we call that when positive charges enter the cell? That's depolarization, right? That's neutralizing this area. Because at rest, the inside of the cell is negative, right? So that's depolarization. And that causes this next region to depolarize, which then causes the next region to depolarize, which then causes the next region to depolarize. So when you have an action potential moving down an axon, we call that a nerve impulse. All right, so a nerve impulse is just a wave of that action potential moving down an axon. Okay, so those are just some of the nice definitions that I want you to be aware of. So you see nerve impulse right here is what? Action potential moving along an axon. That's what an action potential is. All right, so how many parts does an action potential have? Two. Depolarization first, repolarization second. Okay, so that I think you should just pretty much just memorize. All right, so you saw that electrical activity in an axon, and that electrical activity or nerve impulse can flow over an axon very easily, but that electrical signal can't really hop from one cell to another. But nonetheless, neighboring cells in your nervous system have to communicate with each other. So there has to be a way for cells to communicate with each other, but in most cases they can't do it electrically. The way that cells communicate with each other is through a special structure that's between the two cells, and that's what we call a synapse. All right, so we're going to look at a synapse. A synapse is the structural, that means it has a special kind of structure that you have to be aware of. And what's another name for structure? Anatomy, right? It's got a special anatomy, so it's a structural or anatomical and functional. What's another name for function? Physiology. All right, it's a structural and functional unit of communication between cells. So this is how cells can communicate with each other. So for instance, if here we have a neuron and it's got some dendrites on it, all right, and here is an axon and here's the axon terminus, which way do signals go? From left to right or right to left? From left to right, right? So an action potential is going to flow in this direction. And what's a good way to think of that action potential? Is it a chemical signal or is it an electrical signal? It's an electrical signal. So within a neuron, we have an electrical signal. And then here is the second neuron. And it's got some dendrites here, another axon. Which way does this transmit a nerve impulse? Same direction, right? Dendrite, cell body, down an axon. So it's going to go in this direction like this. And would you say within this second neuron, is that going to be an electrical signal or a chemical signal? That's going to be electrical. It's going to be an action potential. All right, but look, we see this big space between the cells right here. That electrical signal can't hop across this space unless it was like a lightning bolt or something, or static electricity. How would, like if I had a lot of static electricity on me and I touched you, what would it feel like? Like a shock, like a jolt. And if it was dark, you'd see like a spark, right? So cells don't communicate with each other via sparks. That just doesn't work. Or lightning bolts. So in this space right here, there are chemicals that are released that diffuse over to this second cell that then establish another electrical signal in the second neuron. So this right here is what we call a synapse. Okay, so within the first neuron, we have an electrical signal. Across the synapse, we have a chemical signal. And that gets reconverted into an electrical signal in the second neuron. So the way information is transmitted from one neuron to from the beginning of one neuron all the way to the second one is what? Electrical turns into a chemical signal and then gets converted back into an electrical signal across the synapse. So sometimes this cell right here is what we call the presynaptic neuron. That's an A, presynaptic neuron. We say presynaptic, why? Why is that presynaptic? Because it's before the synapse, which is right here. So guess what this second neuron is, or this distal neuron? That is the, yeah, that's the postsynaptic neuron. All right, so here we have the postsynaptic neuron. And in between them, we have the synapse, where chemical signals are generated. All right, so let's take a look at a synapse. Let's zoom in to a synapse. All right, what does an axon terminus look like again? It has like a little button, right? It's a little bit of a swelling. You get to an end of an axon, there's a little bit of a swelling. So here is an axon, and here is that electrical signal. What do we call that electrical signal that moves down an axon? That's a nerve impulse. And what really is a nerve impulse? It's just an action potential that's in motion, right? And now you know some components of an action potential. All right, when that electrical, and here is a little swelling at the end of the neuron. This is what we call the axon terminus, or sometimes we call it the synaptic knob or terminal knob or Bouton terminology, goes by all kinds of different names. And what do we have inside that swelling at the end of an axon? What do these guys look like? Oh, they're labeled. These are mitochondria. What are these mitochondria making? They're making ATP, energy, right? We also have some vesicles inside this swelling right here. All right, well, maybe let's see if we can go into this zoomed in region. Yeah, let's zoom into this region right here. Here is a ATP factory, right? Right there, mitochondria. Here are some vesicles. It's loaded with vesicles. And inside the vesicles, there is going to be a signaling molecule that's going to be released when an action potential reaches this axon terminus. It's going to cause these vesicles to fuse with this is what we call the presynaptic membrane. And when these vesicles fuse to the membrane, they will release these signaling molecules into the space between the cells. And that space between the cells we call the synaptic cleft. And then these molecules will diffuse from high concentration to low to the postsynaptic membrane. And there, they can bind to a receptor molecule. And when they bind to a receptor molecule, something's going to change. All right, so let's pretend that the signaling molecule isn't there and the postsynaptic cell is at rest. What's going to be the charge on the membrane when the postsynaptic cell is at rest? It's going to be negative on the inside, right, and positive on the outside. But when these signaling molecules reach this membrane, it allows for sodium to enter the cell. Because where is sodium high concentration all the time? It's high outside the cell. All right, so when the signaling molecule reaches the postsynaptic membrane, it allows for sodium to enter the cell like that. And what happens to the charge inside the cell? It cancels out. What do we call that? That's called depolarization. It becomes depolarized. And that starts another action potential in the postsynaptic cell over here. Okay? So you see an electrical signal in the presynaptic neuron. It gets converted into that chemical signal that diffuses across the synaptic cleft, which then causes depolarization or another electrical signal in the postsynaptic neuron. So it goes electrical, chemical, electrical across the synapse. So this is what we would call a chemical synapse. So this signaling molecule that's stored in these vesicles right here is what we call a neurotransmitter. That's why we call it a neurotransmitter, because this is that's a neuron, right? So that's a neuron, and it's transmitting a signal across the synapse right here. So that's a neurotransmitter. These vesicles that are housing the neurotransmitter are what we call synaptic vesicles, filled with neurotransmitter. And there are various kinds of neurotransmitters that are used in different synapses in our body. And one kind of neurotransmitter, oh, there's labeled neurotransmitter. One kind of neurotransmitter that's used a lot is called acetylcholine. All right, so here is acetylcholine. Sometimes acetylcholine is abbreviated capital A, capital CH. Acetylcholine, that's a very important kind of neurotransmitter. Maybe you've heard of another kind of neurotransmitter, and that is norepinephrine. And there's another one called epinephrine. Epinephrine is the same thing as adrenaline. Probably you all have heard of adrenaline. All right, so these are very powerful stimulators of nerves right at the postsynaptic membrane right here. So this is a synapse. Okay, I don't think I have anything more to say about that. All right, the synapse, you got vesicles filled with neurotransmitter in the axon ending. An action potential causes the vesicles to fuse with the presynaptic membrane that releases the neurotransmitter into the synaptic cleft. And then that neurotransmitter binds to receptors in the postsynaptic membrane. And that binding of that neurotransmitter causes another action potential or depolarizes the membrane. And that depolarization sweeps over the postsynaptic cell. And that causes another nerve impulse in the postsynaptic cell. So that's some neurophysiology. So maybe I'll have to go over that again next time. Okay? Probably you might want to hear it more than just one time. But I want you to at least know the very basic, simple things, like an action potential. How many parts does an action potential have? It just has two parts, depolarization and repolarization. And what causes depolarization? Sodium entering the cell. What causes repolarization? Potassium leaving the cell. Okay. Okay, well, let's go back to anatomy. And let's look at something about the brain. Let's see what I got regarding the brain. Right here. All right, so we're going to start with the central nervous system. Okay, so what are the two main parts of the central nervous system? It's the brain and spinal cord. So let's start talking about the brain first. Okay, and the oldest part of the brain, and it's the most inferior part of the brain. Let me show you this picture right here. All right, so here is the brain. So we see a bunch of cranial bones right here. And then this is the occipital bone with a big hole in it. That's what we call the foramen magnum. And as the brain, or as brain tissue, passes through that foramen magnum, right at this level right here, that tissue is no longer called brain. This is what's called spinal cord. Right? And everything within the vertebral column is spinal cord. Nonetheless, this is all what? This is all central nervous system. So central nervous system is made up of the brain and the spinal cord, and the line that determines where the brain begins or where the spinal cord begins is where? Right at the foramen magnum. Don't forget, what's a foramen again? That's just a big hole in a bone, right? And foramen magnum means what? Biggest hole in the bone. Magnum is the biggest hole in your body right there in a bone. Okay. So the first part of the brain that we're going to look at is what we call the brain stem. This is the part of the brain that the rest of the brain stems from. So the brain stem is this region right here. All right, so let me see if I can find a nice zoomed in picture of the brain stem. I believe so. I believe I can. Okay. So here is a nice picture, zoomed in region All right, so here's that foramen magnum once again. And the brain stem is this region right in here. Not this guy over here, but right in this region right here. And you can see that the brain stem is broken down into three areas. The most inferior part is what we call the medulla oblongata. So going in the foramen magnum, it's this first little bump right here. This is the medulla. And then if we go a little bit more superiorly, can you see another bump right here? So here's the first little bump, that's the medulla. Here's the second little bump, that's what we call the pons. And then above the pons, on top of the pons, is what we call the midbrain right here. These all make up the brain stem. Well, they don't look real important, but let's take a look at what some of the functions of these parts of the brain allow us to do. All right, the medulla oblongata controls heart rate. You have to think about controlling your heart rate. No, that happens automatically or autonomically. So this is a really, really old part of the brain. That part of the brain controls the heart rates of all different kinds of animals, whether you're a leech or a snake or a frog, a turtle, alligator, whatever. This part right here doesn't know how to think, doesn't know how to analyze, all right, much, but it knows how to control, for instance, the heart rate. And what about sneezing? Can you control sneezing? Nope, that's kind of automatic, right? Once you start sneezing. Coughing. Ah, I heard somebody up there. Coughing. That's the part of the brain that controls coughing. And vomiting. Sorry about that, but we got to talk about some of this stuff. Vomiting. You can't control vomiting. That is controlled by the medulla. And even the second part of swallowing. The first part is voluntary. But once you start to swallow something and it gets a little way down toward your stomach, can you stop it and bring it back up? No. Once you start swallowing, right, it goes all the way down. Mostly, it does. Actually, I knew somebody that had a problem with that. They would smoke cigarettes all day long and drink coffee, smoke cigarette, drink coffee, super stimulated. And every once in a while, when he would swallow something, something would happen to that tube between the stomach and his mouth. It's called the esophagus. The autonomic nervous system, that part of the brain, would get confused and it would start to shove food back up into his mouth. And then when we get almost up in his mouth, it would figure out what it was doing and then shove it back down to his stomach. And almost get into his stomach and then it would shove it back into his mouth. So it would sit there and go up and down a bunch of times, and finally it would end up in his stomach. But it would make these really, really ghastly kinds of noises, like really strange. Okay, so... All right, so the medulla controls. The medulla can also control, like, blood pressure. Okay? Blood pressure, heart rate, breathing, respiration. Respiration usually thought of as under voluntary control. Like, I could stand here for about 2 minutes and not breathe. Okay? I could hold my breath, but then what would happen? I'd pass out, and then what would happen after that? You start breathing again because the medulla over here would say, oh, well, you're going to start breathing again whether you want to or not, right? So it controls breathing. So breathing when you're sleeping is under autonomic control. You don't have to worry about breathing when you're asleep. You know what? Unless there's a lesion in the medulla right here, right? If somebody has maybe a tumor or a stroke in this region of the brain, then maybe the breathing... Okay, maybe their breathing has to be controlled voluntarily for every breath that they take. That's a condition. Anybody know what that's called? When you have to actually think about every breath that you take, you have to voluntarily breathe, even when you're sleeping. That's probably terrible to do that because you have to wake up. So you probably put on a respirator when you're sleeping. That's called Odin's curse, right? Because you have to think about every breath you take. So that's the importance of this medulla, right? You just want all those automatic functions to what? Just happen automatically for you. All right, the next area right here is what we call the pons. And the pons is important because it acts like a relay station. So what's a relay station? What's a relay mean? It works with somebody else. Like if I say, hey, I'm not going to be in class later today. Will you tell my instructor later on that I'm not going to be in class, but I really wanted to be there and all that kind of stuff? And I'm there in spirit. So you would be what? The relay of that information. Okay? So the pons acts like a relay for information entering the cerebellum right here. And I'm going to talk about the cerebellum in a little bit. The cerebellum helps you move in a coordinated fashion so that you don't fall on your face every time you take a step. All right, so the cerebellum is really important for control of motion in your body. And the way that signals get in there is that they have to work with the pons to get into the cerebellum. All right, so it's a relay for information between the cerebellum and the cerebrum. And the cerebrum is up over here. This is what's controlling the rest of your body. Okay, the midbrain. Let's talk about the midbrain right here. The midbrain has got a couple nuclei, a couple areas right here. It acts as a pathway for signals going up into the cerebrum. But also in this midbrain right here, it allows you to localize sound. And what do I mean by localize sound? It allows you to understand where sound is coming from. So you have two ears, and if sound is coming from my right, sound is going to reach my right ear before it reaches my left ear, and it's going to go to the midbrain over here, and the midbrain is going to say, oh, well, the sound got to your right ear way before your left ear, so the sound has got to be coming from the right side of your body. So even with your eyes closed, if somebody walked in that door up over there, or that door over there, or this door here, or this door over here, you could tell, even with your eyes closed, what door opened. Right? So that's the job of the midbrain to do that. We call that localization of sound. Another thing that the midbrain does is that it allows you to fixate on an object that's in motion and then figure out where that object is going to end up. So for instance, if I wadded up a piece of paper and threw it like that, you could tell that paper is coming at you, and then probably there's a little spin and it's going to curve a little bit, and that part of the brain can tell how fast that object is going and where it's going to end up. We call that optical tracking. And this part of the brain, you don't have any conscious idea what's happening in this part of the brain whatsoever. It just happens, what, automatically for you. So the midbrain will lock your eyes on that object and will track it. So I would guess baseball players and football players, tennis players have what? A really advanced midbrain right here, because they can track all these things, how they're flying around in space and then figure out how to, you know, like catch a baseball and that kind of stuff. All right, so that's the midbrain. Now there's one other function of the brainstem, and if we consider the pons working together with the medulla, there is another kind of function. And that is what we call the reticular formation. The reticular formation is very important for maintaining consciousness. And another, if we're just going to say the ability to maintain consciousness in one word, that is what? Arousal, right? Staying awake is what I mean. All right, so there are neurons right here that once stimulated, so for instance, if we have these two neurons, if we stimulate the presynaptic neuron, what happens to the postsynaptic neuron? It gets stimulated as well, right? But in the reticular formation, there's going to be another neuron over here with dendrites on it. And here's an axon coming out of the third neuron. Where does it go? It goes back and now actually stimulates the first neuron once again. So once you stimulate this neuron, what happens? It gets stimulated over and over and over again. We call that a reverberating circuit. And that's the kind of circuit that's in the reticular formation, that once it's stimulated, right, those neurons stay awake and stay stimulated, and that maintains consciousness for you. That makes you keep awake. Now, that doesn't happen for everybody. What's that condition called when somebody just falls asleep, just like that, middle of the day? That's called narcolepsy. All right, so that's usually due to a lesion in the medulla or pons or some area right here. And sometimes we don't know exactly where the lesion is, but they might be sitting in class and just all of a sudden falling asleep. Who can we pick on? Oh, everybody all of a sudden is awake. That's good. Or you could be driving down the freeway and then all of a sudden fall asleep. OK? guess what's going to happen to your driver's license if someone ever finds out you have narcolepsy? Well, they yank it, right? Because you're going to kill people, including yourself. So narcolepsy is a really difficult situation to live with. All right, so narcolepsy is a lesion someplace in the reticular activating system or the reticular formation. Sometimes it's called even the RAS. You might run into reticular activating system. That's down here in the brainstem. Yeah, there is, depending on exactly what the lesion is. If it's a metabolic lesion or if it's a structural lesion, and maybe it's a little metabolic imbalance that they can treat. So it all depends if it can be diagnosed. But I would guess in a lot of cases they can't diagnose what the problem really is. If you can't diagnose it, then you can't treat it. Yeah, so it all depends. But it's a problem right in here someplace. All right, the next part of the brain, the diencephalon. All right, the diencephalon is on top of the midbrain, and it has only two parts. All right, let's see if I have even a better picture. I don't think I have even a better picture. Not really. Of the diencephalon. Well, right in this region of the brain, right here, that's what we call the thalamus. And the thalamus, just like the pons, is a relay station. It's a relay station for sensory information. So which way is sensory information going? From your brain to the periphery or from your periphery into your brain? From the periphery into the brain. So it's coming in from your body into the spinal cord. It goes up the spinal cord. And if the reticular activating system is awake, then those signals go up to the thalamus. And then the thalamus directs where those signals should go, what part of the brain the signal should go to. So the thalamus acts as a relay station, again, for signals going to the cerebral cortex. And activation of the cerebral cortex in different areas will give you a sensation on some part of your body. So that's the important job of the thalamus. And the thalamus is also important for producing moods in people and also the sensation of just generalized pain. And is the sense of pain a good thing to have? Yeah, because you want to avoid pain. You want to avoid those damaging stimuli, right? So certainly you want to be able to perceive damage to your body so that you can avoid it, right? So that's an important thing. Oh, say a little bit louder. Probably. I don't know how it can be treated specifically in the thalamus. Mood swings, yeah. I don't know if I can speak much about that. There are other areas over here too, like the hippocampus and things like that, that are important. Mood swings, okay. I don't know if I want to say anything about that. Okay, mood swings. So here is an area that is underneath the thalamus. All right. So what do we call that layer that's underneath the dermis? Hypodermis. So hypo means what? Underneath. So the structure underneath the thalamus is called the hypothalamus. All right. So here's the hypothalamus, and it's kind of underneath the thalamus right here, and the hypothalamus is the major homeostatic control center of your body. And remember, homeostasis is something that's maintaining conditions in your body that's suitable to support life. Like, what's one thing? Temperature, body temperature. The hypothalamus controls your body temperature. It controls your sensations of hunger and thirst. All right, so if somebody can stimulate the hypothalamus, it can make you hungry. What's a kind of drug that stimulates the hypothalamus to make you feel hungry? Nobody knows in here, I'm sure. Okay, but take a guess. Would be like what? Like marijuana. Okay, can stimulate the hypothalamus to give people the sensation that they're hungry. Or thirsty. There's another drug, recreational drug, that gives you the sensation of thirst. And people actually start drinking a lot. And that is methylenediamine methamphetamine. What's that? Does anybody know what that is? That's called ecstasy. Ecstasy can give you the sensation of thirst. Oh, but never mind. Oh, the sensation of thirst. And, oh, this is particularly gruesome, but we have time to talk about this. All right. Can you hurt yourself by drinking too much water?
Yes.
Absolutely. We know that now because not too many years ago, somebody actually killed themselves. I don't know if we've talked about this before, unfortunately, but there was a radio contest, and somebody was going to win, I think, a car or a truck or something like that, depending on how much water you drank. And so there was a very enthusiastic person that really had their heart set on winning this vehicle, and I think they drank like 2 gallons of water. Well, what happens to that water when you drink it? It gets absorbed, all right, goes into your blood, dilutes your blood out, and then where does it go? It's going to go from high concentration to low concentration, right? It's just going to diffuse. It's going to diffuse into all the cells of your body. And so your body swells up. But what part of your body can't swell up because it's got no place to go? Your brain, look, because it's held in the cranial vault right here. So what happens is the brain swells up, but it can leave the cranium one way. How can it leave? Right out through the foramen magnum. Okay, so as you drink all that water, your brain swells up and it gets squished out the foramen magnum. Really gruesome, right? Difficult to treat. And that's actually happened a couple times for people that were abusing ecstasy as well. All right, so they went into the emergency room and had very nondescript kind of symptoms, and they didn't tell the physicians what was wrong with them or what drugs they were on. Okay, so they couldn't get treated, like given massive diuretics or something. So if you have any friends that go to the emergency room, of course, tell the physicians what's wrong with the people or what kind of agents they might be on to counteract them and to treat them. It sort of drowns the insides, that's one way of saying it, but it swells everything up. And it swells the brain, and that destroys the structure. You know, if the brain can kind of swell, you might be okay, but it can't. It doesn't have any place to go. It just gets squished out. When it gets squished out, then the structure is destroyed. Okay, and it can't conduct electrical information. All right, the last thing, oh, we got plenty of time. The last thing that the hypothalamus does is that it controls this little gland right here. All right, and that is the pituitary gland. The pituitary gland is a very important endocrine gland. It controls your testes, it controls your ovaries, it controls your thyroid gland, controls your adrenal glands, and so the part of the brain that controls the pituitary is the hypothalamus. Okay. So that's the important thing about the diencephalon. And let me just take a look at the next slide. The next slide is actually kind of a easy slide. Okay, the cerebrum. That's the biggest part of the brain right here. Let me get rid of the little marks. So here is the cerebrum, and you can see that there are some dark areas and some not so dark areas. Nonetheless, this is all gray matter that's on the surface of the brain. And what you have right here on the cerebrum is that the cerebrum is really big and flat, but if it was really big and flat, it wouldn't fit inside your head. So what do we do for something that has a big surface area and you want it to fit in someplace? You fold it, okay? So what you see right here are all the folds on the surface of the cerebrum, and these folds are what we call gyri, okay? Or no, they're called convolutions. Convolution means what? A lot of twists and turns in it. So a convolution, convolution right here. Convolution has two parts. It's got a high area, like right here, and it's got a depression. And that high area is what we call a gyrus. That's the high area. And that depression is what we call a sulcus. And people know the names of every single gyrus and sulcus in the brain. And maybe we're going to learn one in here, right? But we don't have to know them all. That's what we see on the surface of the brain. Okay, so a convolution are all the folds. All right. And there are 4 major lobes on the brain. 1, 2, 3, 4. So in the front, guess what lobe this is in the front? That's a frontal lobe. And I know I got another picture of this. All right, here's another good picture. of the brain. So here we see the brain stem, and then the diencephalon is deep inside the brain. Right now we're looking just at the surface, so we're going to see a bunch of folds or convolutions on the brain. So this lobe right here, up to this point, that's the frontal lobe. And posterior to the frontal lobe, we have the parietal lobe. Maybe you had to memorize the bones of the skull for the test, I think. Guess what skull bone is right here? That's the parietal bone. And then even more posterior to that is the occipital lobe, because that's where the occipital bone is. And then just right above your ears, what bone is that? That's the temporal bone, and that corresponds to the temporal lobe. So those are the major lobes of the brain. You got frontal, parietal, occipital, and temporal. And next time when we come back, I'm going to talk about some of the functions of these different lobes of the brain. Okay? And then the other thing we got to talk about is the cerebellum right here. All right, so don't forget, if you know some other students in class, we got two quizzes next time. You got an in-class quiz and then a take-home quiz.
The in-class quiz is on what?
The in-class quiz is going to be on the student study guide of the nervous system. All right, so what we're covering right now, nervous system study guide. You know, I graded them, but I don't know if I have them with me or not. I might.